Dave, we're very thankful that you could be here with us tonight. The question I've got are not too difficult or anything, so there's no need to be nervous.
Okay.
That was more for my benefit than yours. Is he on yet?
Hello. It's on. Good to be with you. Thank you for having me. Thanks for dinner.
Great. Okay. So our conversation tonight will focus, obviously, with your experience with cancer. But just so we get to know you a little bit more, we'll start before this very significant event in your life. If we could have the first slide up, please, which we can't see, but here you are with a guy packing up a truck, obviously moving somewhere. Could you tell us, just give us a brief story of your life until that point?
Until that truck, yes. Is my dog in the photograph? Is she in the middle of the road? That's how I know it's my dog. I've been in Canberra with my wife since 1989, and we came to Canberra to be involved in university student ministry, and some of the middle-aged people in this room I first met as university students, and we, through that ministry, I guess had the opportunity to get involved in the lives of many, many people who've ended up around the world, around Australia, and some are still here in Canberra. Out of that ministry also grew the planting of a church, which you may have heard of, called Crossroads Christian Church. And I was one of the founding pastors of that church. And we were working at Crossroads since 1996. And during that time, we'd had four children. The oldest one, Luke, is now 24, then Matthew, 22. Grace is 18 and about to finish year 12. Marcus is 16. And about to move into college. We'd seen the church grow quite significantly. We'd built up a team of staff. And I think we'd come to the point somewhere around 2009 to 2010 where we'd started to think maybe the church and our family are at a point where we could move on and do something else. Right. And we didn't particularly want to leave, but my wife has had a really strong passion for a long period of time for the Indigenous people of Australia. And she'd been working, now it's 14 years, with the Aboriginal Health Centre here. And the thought of moving to the north of Australia and working at planting a new church evolved. And I think kind of God had put this on our minds and we'd started to explore the possibilities. In 2011... midway through the year, we'd really come to a decision as a family, and we still had the younger two with us. The older two had moved off to university and work. But we made a decision as a family that we would finish up here in Canberra at the end of the year and we'd move to Darwin, specifically Palmerston, which is a little city to the south of Darwin, where we would focus on an area that we saw as quite needy, which had a significant Indigenous population, which was very high turnover. A lot of people go up there and maybe they don't like it or can't hack the climate, but they kind of move on fairly rapidly. And we would try and start a church there. A lot of churches had been started and folded. We knew it was going to be a challenge, but we were keen to do that. So we'd kind of been up. We'd found the area we wanted to be in. We'd had the opportunity to... put a deposit down on a house. We were buying a house up there. The kids had enrolled into two different schools. My wife had organised a job with the Aboriginal Health Centre there in Palmerston. I'd gathered together a team of people who were either going to move with us from Canberra or other places to be the nucleus of a new church. Some would connect with us from Darwin as well. Some of those people, in fact, the guy in the photograph, he's going up there at that time with us to be a ministry apprentice, and all of their belongings and our belongings are in two shipping containers. Now, that's November. We weren't planning to get up there until January, but we discovered that the removalist companies in Canberra put up their prices about 30% in December and January because they've got a guaranteed market in the defence community. So many people moved from Canberra to Darwin that they... and we wanted to avoid that cost, so we're pretty much camped in our own home. We'd got rid of most things, That I'm not sure on the exact date of that, but it's kind of towards the end of November. So it's at a point in life where we're pretty much ready to go to drive up to our new life.
Right.
Maybe this is my midlife crisis to the north of Australia. I checked out the fishing, Barramundi, found a boat ramp near the house. We were quite keen. Yeah.
Wow. So how far did you actually get going in the process of moving?
How far did we get?
Yeah.
Nowhere.
With your belongings and the, the truck itself.
Well, see, they said to us, we'll store them in Canberra and ship them up later, but they didn't. They just put them straight on the road. And a few days later, they're up there waiting for us. Yeah.
Wow. Mm. Okay. So everything was in order, as you described, to move to Darwin. Then, as you describe in your book, you were rushed to a hospital.
Yeah.
So tell us the sequence of events that led up to that.
Yeah. It was the 2nd of December 2011, and I'd been speaking at a conference down in Melbourne. And when I was down in Melbourne, it was at a Presbyterian church right in the heart of the city. It was an old building, and they had a dining hall up three flights of stairs. So we'd have all the seminars and the talks down the bottom, and then we'd have to walk up to get a cup of coffee, walk up to have lunch, walk up to have dinner. And every time I got to the top of the stairs, I'd be doubled over panting. Now, it was just three flights of stairs. And I remember thinking, Dave, you are so unfit. You slob. You need to get fit. You need to exercise. You need to watch your diet. And here am I thinking, look, I'm going to go to the great outdoors of Darwin. I'll get it all sorted when I get up there. I just put it down to packing the house and being unfit and stress and so on. A couple of days later, we're back in Canberra, and this was on the Friday, the 2nd of December, and I was in a coffee shop talking with some friends, a bunch of guys that I catch up with annually, and midway through that conversation, I had to interrupt and say to the guys, look, there's something wrong with me. I don't know what it is. I had a tingling around my mouth. I had a pain between my shoulder blades. I had a pain in my chest, which kind of... it was weird. It was almost like it was outside my body, the pain. It was hard to describe. I felt a growing numbness in my left arm and in my left leg. And as I sat there, and we'd been chatting for a while, that numbness seemed to be getting worse. And so I interrupted, and I said to the guys, look, this is what's going on. And one of them had trained as a doctor. His wife was a GP. And he said, right, we've got to stop. We're going to take you straight to hospital. They drove me to Calvary Hospital. On his advice, the driver took me straight into casualty and said, query heart attack. I'll tell you, if you ever want to get through CAS quickly, you might have a sore thumb or something, you think you might have sprained it, query heart attack, you'll get immediate attention. They opened the doors, put me in a wheelchair, hooked me up straight away to an ECG machine. I was thinking that there was probably something going on with my heart. I didn't think I was having a heart attack. I thought I might have had too much coffee. But my heart was fine. So they took me for an X-ray. X-ray showed nothing. But it was this pain between my shoulder blades that had them troubled, because I remember them saying to me that this could be a symptom of an aortic rupture. So basically something broken in the heart. And they didn't want to mess around with it. And so they took me off for a CT scan. And I came back, and then the doctors came back to emergency. I think my wife had arrived by this time, and they started to talk. And then addressed me, and I can still remember what they said at that time. They said, "We think you might have a tumour." And when they said that, the tears started to flow. My throat contracted, and I could hardly swallow. It was just like I'd been sentenced to death. I didn't understand it, and they went on to explain. They said, "With the CT, we saw a very dark mass around your left lung." Right around it, a big area. In the heart of that, they saw a small, darker mass, about the size of a golf ball, maybe slightly larger. They explained that the dark mass was likely a build-up of fluid, and that is a common symptom, sadly, of mesothelioma, the asbestos disease. And so the initial thoughts were that maybe I had meso. Now, I couldn't understand it because I hadn't been exposed to asbestos that I knew about. I wasn't a home handyman, so I certainly hadn't been doing anything with my own house. I wondered about the fact that when I was a kid, I'd done a lot of caving. I wondered if bat poo maybe gave you mesothelioma, but I understand it doesn't. And I was just trying to make sense of this. And then they said, or it could be lung cancer. And that was even stranger. Because to my knowledge at that point of time, the only way you could get lung cancer was by smoking. And I hadn't been a smoker. I'd probably sucked on a couple of cigarettes as a teenager, just trying it out. I'd been around some kids smoking. But I didn't think that could be it. Now, I've since discovered that around about 18% of lung cancers happen for people who are either never smokers or remote distant past smokers, and it's not actually related to the cancer. I didn't know that at the time. So all of a sudden, I've been days away from moving. Our life is ahead of us, and then I'm told that I've got cancer. They're not quite sure at that point exactly what it is. That's on the Friday. But we had to make some massive decisions on the spot. We knew that we couldn't just ignore it and head on up to the Northern Territory. So we gathered the kids, we gathered the couple that were going with us and another couple that were travelling independently, and we said, look guys, we've got some news that we don't quite understand yet. Remember talking to the kids, Dad's got cancer, we don't know how bad it is. But he's going to need treatment. There's going to be surgery. There's going to be a follow-up after that. We don't know, but we just can't go at this point of time. So the kids had actually finished school. They were part of saying goodbye and doing things. They had to be re-enrolled back into school here in Canberra. And we had to say to our friends that we're really sorry, but now you need to make a decision whether you'll go to Darwin anyway or whether you'll stay here. We had to turn around our belongings. And our friends' belongings. All sorts of things happened. And that was a Friday. They let me out because they couldn't operate till Monday. Saturday was my wedding anniversary, 28th wedding anniversary. I have no idea what I had planned. I'm sure it was spectacular, but it didn't involve wearing a hospital bracelet. My son, who'd become a Christian at university, he was down for that weekend. And he was going to be baptised in Lake Burley Griffin on the Sunday. So there were all these great things that were happening. Mind you, also on the Sunday, they were going to vote in the church my replacement because we'd told them 6 months ago that we were leaving. So I think that was one of God's provisions. He knew, we didn't know why it was that I was leaving, being the pastor of that church, but there was a replacement ready to go 2 days after I was diagnosed. Yeah, so everything changed quite quickly.
In your book, you described the moment that the doctors told you what was wrong, and you said there were two words that...
The second word we didn't hear for a little while. It was about 3 days after the operation, I think. They had to take the fluid out, first of all, and that was a shock because it turned out that I had close to 3 litres of fluid around my lung. And that was why I was breathless and why I was going numb. They had to operate to drain that out and to get inside to do two things. One was to actually have a look, see what the tumour was, and ideally take a biopsy of it so they could test it. The other was, and this is quite fascinating, because apparently they've used the same kind of surgery strategy since the 1900s, they needed to close up the gap between my rib cage and my lungs that was filling up with fluid. And what they do is they open you up and they put powder in there, like talcum powder, but I'm sure it's not Johnson & Johnson. But they put this powder in and it creates friction between the pleural lining on the inside of your ribs and the outside of the lungs so that they rub against each other and scar and join together and it closes the gap. So that had to happen. All of these doctors are coming to see me, but the oncologist came a couple of days later. And I remember saying to him, look, what's going on? He said, we can confirm you've got lung cancer. It's an adenocarcinoma. It's a non-small cell lung cancer. He had lots of other things that he was saying as well. I said, well, look, what are you going to be able to do? And this was the second word. He said, I'm sorry, but it's incurable. Now, I'm 49 years of age. I've got 4 kids. I'm at a point where I think it's a kind of a midlife change. We've had 20 years of ministry in Canberra. God willing, we'll have 20 years of ministry in the Territory. And all of a sudden, I'm being told, it's not midlife for you, Dave, it's end of life. I said to the doctor, how long can I expect to live? And he said, well, look, you'll probably see next Christmas. I went, probably. He said, well, people in your condition typically would have 10 to 13 months to live. And again, the tears, the choking, the... How can this be? I remember being absolutely devastated at this point. All of a sudden, it's like I'm being told my life's finished. And it may not be actually finished at this point of time, but it's not going to get better, it's going to get worse. And that's one of the big differences, I think, to that point of time. I'd been sick before, I'd been to hospital before, I'd had diseases before, I'd broken bones before, but the prognosis is always, yeah, you'll get better. Take these drugs and you'll be fine. Wait a little while and you'll be fine. We'll set these bones and we'll do some physio and you'll be fine. But now I'm being told, no, you won't be fine. And I remember thinking, no, why can't you just cut it out? And he said, look, it's already spread. We couldn't cut it out because we wouldn't know that we'd got it all. The cancer had ruptured and the fluid build-up was because it had started to spread into the pleural lining. It had found its way into the lymph system, which is a superhighway around the body. I was being told that no, surgery wasn't an option, radiation therapy wasn't an option. Yes, they could give me chemotherapy, but it wouldn't be to get rid of the cancer. It would be to help slow it down, perhaps, improve some of the conditions of life, although if you know anything about chemotherapy, the doctors described it as like working out how much poison would kill me and then dialing it back a notch so it doesn't. And there are many times when I kind of think, what would be better, having chemo or just ignoring it and living? Because you feel like you're not living once you're being so heavily poisoned. That was the start of a very strange and very difficult journey.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you described some of the effect physically. What about emotionally and spiritually? How did it affect you?
Yeah, quite hard. I thought, aside from being a bit breathless and feeling these latter symptoms of numbness, that I was actually reasonably well. And what happened when I went into hospital, rather than getting better, is I got progressively worse. The drain that was supposed to remove the fluid out of my lungs blocked up. My lungs collapsed, or my left lung collapsed, multiple times. I got an infection, not sure that it was pneumonia, but it was like that, which was very hard to control. My body started to shut down. I became sicker and sicker and sicker in hospital, to the point where my wife, and she was pretty well informed to be able to assess these things being a doctor, she didn't say this to me at the time, but she seriously feared that I would not come out of hospital. Give you one picture of this. I went into hospital at 93 kilos in weight. I came out 3 weeks later weighing 78 kilos. I went in being able to do all sorts of things. I mean, I'd packed up the house, I'd carried furniture, I'd moved boxes and so on. I could barely move in bed, let alone get out of bed and unassisted go from a bed to a bathroom. And to be honest, it took me months before I could walk around the block unassisted. I became very, very weak. So that's what's going on physically, but we're complicated beings, aren't we? You know, you have a hard day at work, and you come home, you've got a headache. It's not because somebody hit you on the head, it's because of the stress. And we've got physical and emotional going on together. And so I've got massive physical going on. And the drugs are pretty hard as well. I had to change one of the drugs because whether I was awake or asleep, I was experiencing incredibly frightening hallucinations. I felt extraordinarily lonely in there. And look, my wife and my kids and so many friends visited, but everything is happening so rapidly that you could be on your own for an hour and a half and feel like you're alone. The fear that was associated with all of that. And I think the shutdown of my body, the shutdown of my emotions, all of these things, they were also affecting me spiritually. So I believed in God. I was praying a lot. But I found myself constantly being filled with doubts. So there are times when I think, yes, I'm praying, but am I praying to anybody really, or am I kidding myself? I remember thinking, look, I have spent the last 20 years or more trying to persuade people to take God seriously, encouraging them to look at the evidence with Jesus, his death and his resurrection, saying to them, if we trust in Jesus, we can have a hope of life beyond the grave. And all of a sudden, I'm facing the grave and I'm wondering whether I've made it all up, whether it's true, whether there is a God, and if he is there, whether he's able to do something for me, whether he wants to do something for me. All these things, they're kind of spinning around in my heart and mind, and I'm struggling. And they actually say that one of the difficult things for people who go through cancer is that they become exceptionally vulnerable to depression. And I think that I was slipping into depression. I'll give you one example of this. We went, and my wife is a GP. She'd done all of this research into what the best drugs would be. She tapped into different specialists and so on. If you go in and see the oncologist and you don't have anything to contribute, they will recommend certain drugs because they're the normal drugs. And typically they're the free drugs that the government will support. But the research that Fiona had been given from some oncologists and some respiratory surgeons and others was saying, look, if you use these three drugs instead of the normal three drugs, there'll be less side effects, there'll be a better prognosis. And at that point in time, we're kind of clutching medically for the best possibilities available to us. And I remember going in and Fiona saying to the oncologist, look, we really want Dave to have carboplatin, not cisplatin. We want him to have Alimta rather than the other drug. We've discovered that if you combine the Alimta with Avastin, there are better outcomes. And he says to us, look, yes, we can do that, but it's going to be expensive. And we say, well, how expensive? And he said, well, the first four visits are going to cost you just under $8,000 each visit. After that, the government will probably kick in and pay for one of the drugs, and so it will drop to $3,000 per visit. The chemo is something that you will do three weekly. And here's the catch. If it works really well, then you do it for longer, and so it gets even more and more expensive. And he said, to be honest, some people who've gone down this sort of path have had to remortgage or lose their houses over it. And I'm giving you this story so you understand my mind and the depression. Because I remember coming out and saying to Fiona, my wife, forget it. Look, don't worry about spending all this money. If I'm going to die anyway, the last thing I want to do is kind of take money away from my wife and my children when I'm gone. If I've only got a year left, why waste $100,000 on me? And she very sensitively and professionally and pastorally said something like, stop being an idiot. And that's where I was at. So all of this is going on, and it's a big issue for me, this whole question. If there's no hope of being cured, and that's what they're saying to me, am I without hope altogether? And so this question about whether what God said and what God promises were true.
Yeah, I think we'll come back to that in a bit.
Yeah.
But before we get to that, if we can have the next slide, please. You did make it home that Christmas.
I didn't know we were having a slideshow. But
you won't be able to see it. It's just for them.
I think we've had that slide.
Did we? The next one, please. Okay.
I'll tell you, though.
Our IT department.
Oh, that's my beautiful wife, I think. I don't normally look up at her. I normally look across or down. Anyway, yeah.
So
we're on holidays, sort of.
Right. So how are you feeling at this point?
Yeah, that's about 6 weeks after I was diagnosed, and that's why I'm looking so skinny. And I haven't started chemo at that point. I had to regain enough strength to be able to take it.
Of course.
So that's late January. It's a few days before I began chemo, which was after Australia Day. Friends who had a little holiday house at Maruya said, why don't you go away and spend a few days together? How am I feeling? Well, I'm feeling very weak. We go to the beach and Fiona puts down a chair and I sit in the chair. Right. And we can't be too far away from the car park because it's a shuffle to get there, to be honest. Part of it's the surgery, because what I didn't say is when the first operation failed, they had to redo it and sent me to another hospital. And that's how I eventually got better, because they did a better job in the other hospital.
Right.
But I had three scars under here. It looks like I've been in a bikey fight and been knifed three times, except it's much more mundane. I'm very weak at that point. I'm starting to look at the Bible with Fiona again. Found 2 Corinthians to be incredibly helpful. But it's still tough, still struggling.
Okay. What about the effect on the family? You mentioned you have some kids and your wife.
Look, it's a little hard to know how other people process things, even your own kids, even your own wife. But we thank God for how he helped them to handle it. Fortunately, our whole family were together at that time because there was a conference going on in Canberra that had brought our son from Sydney back to the conference. And we were all there, so we were all able to kind of talk and explore these things together. But at the start, I don't know how they coped with being told that there's virtually no hope for Dad.
Yeah.
I remember being in hospital having conversations with my older kids, not with the youngest boy, but with the older kids, talking about life without their dad. and that's one of the hardest things I've ever done. Particularly my daughter, who was 15 at the time, and just awful to think about. They were terrific, though. They really were. And it was my son, who's now 16. He's quite extraordinary because he tunes into to dates and times. He knows exactly when I've got my next chemo. Whereas my daughter, I mean, she is blonde, but I don't think that's why. She doesn't have any idea. But there was
no offense to blondes, I'm sure.
I was blonde too. It was literally 1 year after. So, and the same conference was on in Canberra that I'd been speaking at the previous year, and I'd been saying that I was going to that. And our boy who was 14, is having a little bit of a spat with his mum, saying that he's not going to school because he hates school, and it's useless going to school at this time of the year anyway, because all they do is that they either get you cleaning up the classroom or watching movies.
Okay.
And I remember I was lying in bed and Fiona was rushing off to work, and so there was a little bit of argy-bargy going on, and it was my job then to make sure that he got to school.
Mm.
So Fiona left for work and I'm walking down the corridor and I hear crying. And my 16-year-old, he's a pretty tough kid. I don't think I'd seen him crying much before at all, and he's sobbing in the shower. Absolutely sobbing. And I waited till he got out of the shower and he got dressed, and I went into the bedroom where he was and I said, what's going on, mate? And he said, I'm just so scared that I might lose you. And this is a year later, and it was on the exact anniversary morning. Now, with my daughter, Grace, when this book came out, I wrote something in each and gave a copy to each of my kids, and my wife said that she heard Grace crying and she went and she was reading the book. And she said that, and this 15 or 16 months later, it says the first time I've had a good cry. First time I had a cry about Dad going through this. So we think God helped them incredibly. Huge what my youngest has been through. This is not in the book and this is not on anything you and I have talked about, but the year before we were travelling around the north of Australia and we were trying to work out this question as to whether we'd go to Darwin. We'd just been to the Millstream and Karajini National Parks in the Pilbara. It's iron ore country and it's desert, and it was a strange day. It was hot and there were very high winds. I drove all morning and we had a swim in this pool, and then Fiona took over the driving after lunch, and we were going down this road and all of a sudden the camper trailer behind our four-wheel drive started to push sideways, and Fiona didn't quite know how to correct it, and there was high winds and within a split second our four-wheel drive is rolling. And we rolled four times and landed on our wheels. So it's about 100 k's an hour we're travelling.
Yeah.
My daughter, who's in the seat behind Fiona, who's driving, and I'm in the passenger seat, she calls out, "Where's Marcus?" And we turned around, he's not in the vehicle. He'd been thrown out while we rolled. I remember none of the doors would open, the whole thing had been crumpled, and I jumped out of the window, the adrenaline flowing, obviously, because I had a number of broken ribs, and rushed over. And basically, I'm running through our belongings. There's debris for 100 or more metres.
Right.
To the point where the roof box, which was on the top of the four-wheel drive, is smashed and sitting there. And our son, Marcus, is lying on his back screaming. We thought he could have broken his back. We're stunned that he's alive. We have no idea how he got out of the four-wheel drive without it rolling on him. Yeah, and so this is only 14 months before. And that was a lot of trauma there. My wife was Royal Flying Doctor to Perth and then back to Canberra. She had multiple fractures and so on. So the family, in a sense, the four of us, we'd been processing all of that, and it took Fiona 3 to 4 months before she could sleep in a bed. And then there was a long period of rehab to get the arm working. It only goes up to here now, and she goes swimming, and she's invented a swimming style she calls free dog. It's half freestyle and half dog paddle.
Yeah.
So all of this is in the background, right? And we're just coming to grips with these things.
Yeah.
And then Dad's got cancer.
Yeah. Wow. Very tough. So you did say you had to wait a few months before you can start on the chemo because of I think you explained that already.
Yeah.
In your book, you actually go quite into the technical side of things in terms of the form of your type of cancer.
Yeah.
Did you want to talk about
Well, that? It's kind of interesting, particularly if you're into these scientific things, but it's interesting because it's part, I think, of the next frontier of how they're going to deal with cancer. You might have heard often on news stories about some genetic thing they've discovered that's causing the cancer and some special treatment they've got. Well, the curious thing for my wife with me was, why is my husband, who's only 49 and not a smoker, got lung cancer? So she got together with others and they were doing some research and discovered that there are significant numbers of people who have particular genetic mutations, problems genetically that cause the cancer or cause the cancer to be able to grow. And so they did a test on me and found I didn't have a particular thing that is reasonably common, about 40% of my lung cancer. So then she approached the oncologist and said, well, we want to do another test. Now, he said there's no point in doing that because only 3 to 4% of people have it. That was his second or third mistake, actually. But Fiona said, we're going to do it anyway. He said, it was actually quite expensive. And she said, we've got to pay for it anyway. we actually had to push this oncologist, who's brilliant, but he just hadn't been exposed to these things. We had to push him to do this testing. They sent off my biopsy. And to his shock and to our pleasure, it came back that I had a particular genetic mutation. Now, if you want the kind of scientific thing behind it, this is my simplest description. In my DNA, and it's only within the cancer cells, so it's not something that you could detect in the body prior to having cancer at this stage. In the cancer cells, they've discovered that my second chromosome has flipped around 180 degrees and fused with the fifth chromosome. And what does that do? Well, it's kind of like, changing the analogy, it's kind of like turning a tap on so the water can flow through the hose. The hose being the pathway for the cancer. And this chromosomal problem, which is genetic mutation, causes the tap to be on the whole time. So there's a pathway in my body that enables the cancer to grow. Now, they've discovered drugs, or invented drugs, or whatever you do, that will turn the tap off so the cancer can't grow. Only problem at the moment, and we're lobbying the government on this right now, is it still is not funded in Australia. So that drug costs a patient, it's 2 tablets a day, and each tablet costs $135. $7,400 a month, $88,000 a year, if it works really well and you live for 12 years, then you've spent $1 million on this drug. Now, it's extraordinary, isn't it? It's just unaffordable for most people. I haven't accessed that drug yet because the chemo has worked in a profound way that was unexpected. But if my cancer gets worse, that's the next step. And then the idea that they said to me back then, look, keeping on chemo might open up options for treatment. Well, it's nearly 3 years now, and in that time, that drug has been superseded by another drug which is about 10 times more powerful, which if people fail on this drug because the cancer finds a way around that hose, you can move on to that. And then they're refining that, and they'll move on to something else. So I share that with you because that kind of medical progress is happening in a whole range of cancers. And there's another strategy that they're developing too, and it's called immunotherapy. It's basically boosting the body's own capacity to fight the cancer. Doesn't matter which sort of cancer it is. So some of the cancers which have been almost impossible to treat, immunotherapy is potentially opening up new strategies, which is not attacking the cancer, it's actually boosting the body's capacity to fight it itself as a foreign body. Yeah,
fantastic stuff. Okay, I think you spoke about a little bit about how chemo affected you. You still are doing it.
Yeah.
How does it affect you now? I mean.
Yeah. Look, it's pretty potent. It really is. It makes me quite sick. So my life now, I've nearly been 3 years. So in January, I will have been 3 years on non-stop chemotherapy. Only a few years back, they would have given me 4, 6, or a maximum of 8 doses and then said, we've done the best that we can for you, good luck. They've got this strategy now of backing it off slightly and using it as maintenance therapy. By maintenance, they mean hold the cancer. Doesn't necessarily destroy the cancer, but hold it. There might be some improvements on it. Now, my oncologist, right through the whole process, said, this chemotherapy doesn't get rid of the cancer. So what's happening is three months into it, I have a scan. They see, 28 millimetres across the tumour. Another 3 months, and it actually had shrunk, 24 millimetres. Another 3 months, and it's continuing to shrink, so the size of a marble. Another 3 months, the size of a pea. I remember a mate saying, good, we're going for a mustard seed next time. And on the 31st of May last year, my wife, who somehow or other gets these scan results before I go and see the oncologist, comes home from work, puts a fax on the bed and says, read it. So I'm trying to read it, like medico, gobbledygook, blah, 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 blah. I can't read anything. And then she says, just read the last line. And it said, no evidence of neoplasm. Now, that sounded like some kind of bandage you put on. Right? I didn't know what it was. I didn't think I'd been taking neoplasm or whatever. And she said, look, go and look it up. She's really, great medical manner, my wife. But so I went to Dr. Google and looked in Wikipedia. And sure enough, neoplasm, tumour or cancer. I said, for real? Like, is this saying what I think it's saying? She said, yeah, there's no evidence of cancer. Now, what they're saying is our imaging device, our CT scan, can no longer see a tumour there. What was that big has shrunk to the point where if it's there, it is so small that we cannot see it. And that's saying nothing about what might be going on in other parts of my body or whether there's cells that are still active. But that's the best medical news that any kind of assessment can give me, then, now, any time. Unless they've got a new way of analysing what's going on in the body than they do now, that's the best news I can ever get. It's what they started to call me Ned. My name's Dave, by the way, but Ned stands for no evidence of disease. That's the lingo now. They don't say remission so often, they say no evidence of disease. But every now and then he slips into saying, well, you've been in remission for a while now. I go, yeah, that's good. And since the 31st of May last year. But because my oncologist is a pessimist, he's a realist, he assumes that it's only not there because of the chemo, he says, keep going. So every 3 weeks I go back, I get very anxious about it. I was saying to somebody over dinner, a day or so beforehand, I start to get anxious. I drive toward the hospital. I'm feeling anxiety. By the time I go in and get the needles into my veins and I'm having the poison into me, I'm already dripping with sweat. I feel like just pulling out the lines and running away from it. If they give me any opportunity to have a break, I just go, yes, thank you. See you later. It's difficult, and I think it's my brain, the kind of, you know, conditioning that when I go to the hospital, I get these horribly potent drugs. Within 2 days, I'm bedridden. Sometimes it's almost like my whole body's in disarray. Nothing's working properly. Think of the worst flu and kind of migraines and vomiting and all these other things. And that's what's going on. And it's so counterintuitive because you think that you're desperately sick, but this desperate sickness is what's fighting the cancer. Because chemo works basically on the strategy of attacking the fastest growing cells in the body. Cancer cells grow rapidly. So it'll attack the cancer. But, you know, some, particularly with breast cancer, so many of the women lose their hair. Hair's rapid growing cells. I mean, in my case, everything just thinned out hair-wise. And you know, the skin problems and gum problems. I'm now in the middle of six root canal therapies and crowns because my teeth are falling apart from 3 years of chemotherapy. I do brush my teeth, by the way. My mother said morning and night, and I still do that, but it's, you know, it's the poison. So, yeah, I keep going with it. And my life is now a three-weekly cycle. I'm back in again on Monday. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, we're just about halfway through. We won't stop for a coffee, but we will have coffee at the end. So another half an hour to go or so. But if you have questions for Dave, feel free to write them or you can ask them at the end. If you want to write them, you can hand them to me. You can actually give it to Daniel, whom I'll point to towards the end, and then he'll give them to me. All right, so we'll continue. So you've spoken about the physical. Well, we're going to come back to the spiritual, the effect on you, yeah. On you spiritually.
Yeah.
What? Obviously, you've written a book about your experience. If we could start with in that condition that you were in, where it was pretty hopeless, really.
Yeah.
How did you find hope?
I think I needed to reassess what I currently believed. So it's not that I had to find something new.
Right.
It was all there. But I had to look at it again. I had to ask the question, is this real? Is there a God? Did God make himself known through Jesus? Did Jesus die on the cross? Did he rise from the dead? Did God's promises kind of stand the test of reality? And so I'm talking to people, I'm getting back into the Bible, people are kind of trying to encourage me with stuff, people are praying for me. I remember going back and looking at some of the simple things that persuaded me to become a Christian in the first place, parts of the Bible that really kind of hit home when I was 18 years of age. Books like a little book called More Than a Carpenter, Evidence for the Resurrection, which helped persuade me that Christianity was based in history. When I was 18 years of age, I'm reading it again as a 49-year-old. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So I guess when the rubber hits the road, as they say, you're thinking about it not as a theoretical possibility, but you know you wanted something that's solid, something that is concrete, and the resurrection and the fact that it's historical, that was the that's what did it for you. That's what you put your hope in.
Yeah, see, if I had no hope of a cure, to have hope, then I had to have something beyond the cure. Something that would stand the test of whether I was cured or whether I wasn't cured. Because I remember thinking how hard it was to have a terminal illness. But then one day it kind of dawned on me, I'd always had a terminal illness. It's called life. We all die. And so many people, particularly in the cancer community, place all of their hope in being healed, in being cured. And, you know, I could tell you the statistics of how many people with lung cancer, how many people with breast cancer, how many people with ovarian cancer, how many people with pancreatic cancer. I know exactly the statistics for every one of those. You name any cancer and I could tell you exactly how many people are going to die. It's 100%. not necessarily of the cancer. They might be cured of that, but they're still going to die. And that hit me one day, and I just thought, wow, we really do need something substantially more. And that's why I wanted to write this book. Because, look, I'm 100% pro-cure. I'm a great fan of all the medical research that's gone into providing the drugs that I've been on and the possible drugs that I might need in the future. I'm keen to encourage anyone on that journey and do anything that I'm capable of doing that might help them. But at the end of the day, we're still going to die. And I think that what cancer did is it just made me not forget that. We live in a world where we kind of push death away and very sanitized. And certainly as a young person, it's just so remote. It's not something that you think about. I'm sure one day, yeah, I know. I know that that's the reality, but it doesn't impact me. But now I'm lying in hospital. My body's shutting down. We've just drawn up a will. I'm talking to their kids about life without their dad. It's front and centre. It's like plugging that issue into an amplifier, and I'm being hit with it full blast. Yeah. So I had to ask those questions, and I want other people to ask those questions as well.
Yeah, you say in your book, some people... like the idea of God and religion at a funeral. They like thinking about ending up in heaven or going to a better place. But when you're facing death, it doesn't matter what you like to hear or think about or what your personal preferences are. What matters is evidence. And I think that's what you've been explaining.
Yeah, look, I might like to think that such and such, Aunt Mavis is in a better place. And we hear that sort of thing all the time, but is she? How do you know that she is?
Yeah.
Is there a place? Or is death it? Your body rots and there's nothing else. Most of my atheist friends think that we're just chemicals, and when those chemicals have stopped interacting, they break down, and that's it. You don't have to worry about death. It's just non-existence.
Yeah.
But as a Christian, I believe that there's actually resurrection of the dead. Yeah. And if we have rejected God, then we'll be separated from God for eternity, and that's bad. The Bible calls it hell. But if we put our trust in God, then we'll be united with God for eternity, and that's brilliant. And the Bible calls that heaven. And so these are real issues, like when you're facing your own death.
Yeah.
It's not the place for wishful thinking. It's not the place for fiction or make-believe. Honestly, I had no desire to watch a TV show, a movie, or read a novel when I was in hospital. It was not the time for fiction. I wanted to engage with reality, big time. I want others to do the same.
Mm. You also say in your book...
I say a lot in the book, don't I? It's quite in the book. It must be a great book.
Actually, it's a very small book, but somehow you say a lot. Anyhow, you say blood tests, ultrasounds and CT scans will never reveal my deepest problem.
Yeah.
What is that problem?
Yeah, look, it's tied up with the fact that I already had a terminal illness called life. Mm-hmm. And why is it a terminal illness? Why is it going to end in death? Well, I don't know exactly why my circumstances or how my circumstances would work out, but the big picture that God makes clear is that we now live in a world where death reigns, where everybody faces their own death because humanity has turned its back on God. And the Bible calls that sin. And it's something that we've all got. Sin's not doing bad things. Sin's turning away from God, seeking to be number one and live without God, as though God's irrelevant. And most people live that way. That's the deepest problem with inside us. And the only way that problem can be overcome is by God forgiving us. Yeah. And he promises to do that if we trust that the death of Jesus paid for that sin, paid for that rejection of God, so that we can be forgiven and restored into relationship with God. And so my greatest problem wasn't the cancer. My greatest problem was my rejection of God that he had already dealt with in Jesus. Hmm. That's what I'm getting at. Yeah.
Yeah. So, when you come to write a book, you obviously, you called it Hope Beyond Cure. Mm. Did you want to explain why you called it? Why the title?
Yeah, one of the things that I started doing soon after I came out of hospital was I started writing because I've been a preacher most of my life, always communicating verbally, but never really written anything, and all of a sudden I'm stuck in bed.
Right.
And they went and replaced me at the church anyway, for which I was very grateful. But a number of friends said, well, why don't you just write some stuff? It'll help us to know how to pray for you. Mm. It'd be good to hear your reflections on things. And I started to do that and covered a whole range of different issues. But not only did I start to write stuff, I also started to read what other people were writing. And I've made a lot of kind of online friends with other people who have cancer.
Right. Yeah.
And one day, there was a post on a particular forum that I read pretty regularly that said, this was the heading, from NED to no hope in less than 2 weeks. So someone was writing that they had had no evidence of disease, and now there is no hope for them, less than 2 weeks later. Now, there was actually it's a little complicated as to why that was going on, but I thought, why no hope? The only hope to that point of time was there being no evidence of disease, which is fine in relation to cancer, but it doesn't ultimately help you for what you die on afterwards.
Hmm.
So I've since discovered that I'm in a bad kind of family tree when it comes to cancer. My grandfather had cancer. He had bowel cancer in his 50s. He had another cancer in his 80s. He died in his 90s, but not from cancer. He still died. My father was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma 6 months before my diagnosis, had 5 courses of chemotherapy, was meant to have 6. I think he did have 6, but after the 5th, there was no evidence of the disease. It was very effective with his cancer. But he's going to die too, and so am I. And it's that issue that I wanted to give people hope with. Yeah, look, I hope that people who need medical attention get it, and it's good to hope for that. But I hope that they've got a bigger hope, a substantial hope that will go beyond the grave. So that's why I called it that.
Yeah. So just think about how we and be it for our family, for our friends, for our colleagues who go through the experience of suffering cancer, how we may be able to help them. What are some of the tips? What to do, what not to do, that kind of thing.
Yeah, look, I'm very grateful of the support of family, the support of friends, the support of church, and yet I know how hard it is for people to actually connect with others who are going through the journey with cancer. Many of my friends have actually said that they were scared to visit me. At least they're honest. I think a lot of others were scared as well. They just didn't tell me. Part of it was, what would I look like? Would I look... you look at the photos of me in hospital, I'm looking pretty bad. And cancer's not a great thing. And so part of it was that was the fear. Part of it was the fear of actually spending time with somebody who was dying. Part of it was the fear of feeling so out of their depth that they'd have no idea what to say and they're worried they'd put their foot in their mouth.
Right.
All sorts of reasons that we're fearful. I tell you that my wife and my daughter entered a team each in the Canberra Cancer Council's Relay for Life a few months after I was diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said to me, oh, you've got to come because the first lap is the survivor's lap. Now, I didn't feel like a survivor. It had only been 3 months.
Right.
But I think if you're breathing, you're a survivor, right? So anybody. But I didn't want to go. I really didn't want to go. And you know why I didn't want to go? Because there'd be people there who had cancer. I didn't want to be around people with cancer.
Right.
And I had cancer. I'll tell you, more recently, I live on the north side of Canberra, my kind of local shops, well, there's a couple, but one's Lynham Shops, and there's a guy who sits outside a cafe there nearly every day. And I'd go past to do some shopping and I'd see him there and I noticed that he'd had surgery. He had a scar on his forehead that went this way and that way. It looked like maybe they'd removed a brain tumour or something. And then I noticed that there was something growing above his left eye. Gradually over a period of weeks, whatever it was that was growing there grew so large that it started to cover his eye and eventually it would be the size of a grapefruit sticking out of the front of his head. Completely covering his left eye. Now, that is a very confronting cancer. You wouldn't have seen any evidence looking at me of anything going on inside, but this is kind of visible, right?
Yeah.
When I was a teenager or young 20s, I watched a movie called Elephant Man. This man reminded me of that. It was very, very grotesque. And I remember thinking, I reckon that he must scare the pants off everybody. And one of the things I noticed is he's nearly always sitting there on his own. And I thought, Dave, you of all people ought to go and talk to him. So did I? No, I walked around the shops the other way so I wouldn't have to. I was appalled at my behaviour, as well as the fact that I'd actually had to preach on the Good Samaritan just before. And I thought I did a great job of acting out the Levite and the priest, but that's not what God called me to do.
Not quite.
And so I then went up to him and I introduced myself and I said, mate, must be pretty hard with that growing there. And I said, is it a cancer? And he said, yeah, it's a cancer. And I said, have you been having treatment for it? And he said, yes. And I said, do you mind if I sit down? I've actually got cancer too. Pretty much most times now, if I see him, we sit down and we have a chat. He's normal. He's a person.
Yeah.
He looks different. Yeah. But I thought, look, if I found it hard to get over that hurdle, how much more are other people going to find that hard? Yeah. And so what I want to say is overcome the fear. Just being there is so valuable, being present and available. People did all sorts of practical things for us. And I think being practical is so helpful. People from church bought meals for the first 3 or 4 months. We didn't have to cook. We felt guilty about that all the time. People came around, and it's interesting that the two guys that were packing the truck, when they brought all the stuff back, the same two guys were there to unpack the truck. And they'd never done that before. It was 6 weeks later. But the second time, it was over before you knew it, because I had 30 helpers from church there helping me to do it. I just sat there on a chair like this saying, lounge room, bedroom, kitchen, out the backyard, and it took no time. But the practical help. One guy noticed that our front windows, which are, our house was built in 1948, so it's got the old kind of wooden windows falling apart. Four kids, three of them boys, throwing balls. We've broken most of the window panes. Over the last year or so, maybe because we thought we were leaving and that they'd probably knock down the house if we sold it, we just didn't bother. So we had sticky tape and contact and masking tape holding the windows together. And one guy came around and said, look, would you like me to fix your windows? Yeah. He'd never done it before, but he went and bought some glass and bought some putty and got on YouTube and worked out how to do it. And he fixed all of our windows for us. And
nice.
That is so helpful. And it makes such a difference. I've actually just started getting together with a group of people to set up something that we're, at this stage, it's not functioning yet, but we've started to set up something that we're calling Cancer Hope. And HOPE is an acronym, like the letters stand for something.
Yeah, okay.
H stands for Helping Hands. Last Friday, I got to speak at the Australian Defence Force Academy at the invitation of an OC for one of the squadrons. And I talked to these guys, men and women, and said, look, would any of you be interested in helping out people who can't afford and haven't got the time and are struggling with cancer to do up their backyard, to remove the rubbish, to paint the house, to do all these things? And they lapped up the idea. Mm. And I reckon there'd be people in churches, particularly Reformed churches, a lot of capable people, all sorts of possibilities. O stands for opening opportunities. And I want churches to see themselves as communities that could support people. P stands for prayer partnerships. Yep. I'm in a cancer support group. I'm on online communities with other people with cancer. It is one group in the world that are open to being prayed for. And people like to share their story. And they like to connect with others.
Yep.
And so I'm hoping that we can establish some prayer and support groups hosted by churches. E stands for exploring eternity.
Yeah.
Because, as I said, hopefully people will be cured of cancer, but even if they are, they still need to explore eternity.
Hmm.
And an event like this is an opportunity to help people explore eternity.
Hmm. Wow.
So there's all sorts of things.
That's very helpful. All right, well, there's that time now. You have an opportunity to ask Dave some questions. And if you prefer to write your questions, feel free to do so. Daniel is at the back. Give it to him and he'll pass it on to me and then I'll read it to Dave. So,
Joel, speaking in Wollongong last Sunday and at Hope Theatre, aptly named, it's a big 600-seat theatre at the University of Wollongong, And the guy at the front, like you, I was just giving a talk, but then he was open to fielding questions.
Right.
He said, there's a number coming up on the screen now. If you want to text your questions, I will get them on my phone and I'll communicate them to Dave. Yeah. So you got your phone there? I thought it was so professional.
Maybe next time.
Yeah.
Okay, any questions?
Yeah, you don't have to write them down. You feel free to...
Yeah, you don't have to write them down. You can just stand up and ask them.
Oh, he's a man. Worth his weight in Tim Tams.
He's actually my housemate. I'd say yes to that. Yes, that's true.
Thank you. Yes. The church plant didn't go ahead. One of the trainees that... we were taking two trainees, and they were both married. One stayed in Canberra and did his ministry traineeship down here. The other went to Darwin, and we put him in touch with another minister up there because they really wanted to explore territory ministry. People who had to go, because a number of them were defence families, so they were going up to Palmerston anyway. They went along to other churches. And, I think it... All the others that we'd made contact with there, who were up there, have also gone to other churches. So there's still opportunity and there's still need. Before God, I don't think that'll be us. The chemo knocks me around so much that the thought of being in 32 degrees and 99% humidity, it'd be very difficult. So, yeah.
Other questions? Otherwise, I'll ask you from one that we've received written.
Mm.
How has all this strengthened your overall ministry?
Yeah.
And what opportunities?
Look, I think it's opened up opportunity, definitely. And if you'd said to me 4 years ago, or if God had said to me somehow 4 years ago, I want you to minister to people with cancer, and I want you to do that with real integrity, somebody who knows what they're going through, I'd say... God, let me find someone. I've learnt to delegate, so I'll get somebody, right, who can do it. But having been diagnosed with an incurable cancer, to be able to get alongside other people who are facing that, I count that a privilege. Because it is tough, it is lonely, it is scary. It's debilitating, all sorts of things. And we're all different, and I can't simply say, look, I know what you're going through either, because I don't.
Yeah.
But there's some kind of bond there, and there is some kind of opportunity for me to be able to speak with integrity into this community.
Mm.
And it's a growing community. They're saying that somewhere between 1 in 2 and 1 in 3 Australians will have cancer at some stage in their life.
Yeah.
So let me number you off. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. You know, and we're saying 1 each time I do that. Yeah, and in my family, sadly, my grandfather, his 2 sons, my father's 2 sons, my brother got diagnosed with a melanoma after me. That's been treated. To be honest, as I look at my 3 boys and girl, I know, and I haven't talked with this one about them much, but I know there's real possibilities that they might face cancer in the future because there are things about us, genetically or whatever, that we don't understand. But that's quite likely.
Yeah.
So it is a privilege to be able to have that ministry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, here's another one. Should Christians pray and wait for God's healing rather than seek or depend on medicine, basically? Yeah.
What I would like to do is answer that with the exact words that were written, except for one. So I would like to say Christians should pray and wait for God's healing and seek and depend on modern medicine.
Hmm.
Not either or.
Yeah.
God is not only the God of the miraculous, though he is the God of the miraculous. God is also the God of modern medicine and knowledge and technology and drugs and resources. God's given us brains. He's given us the wealth. He's given us the technology to be able to do these things. And See, the danger of saying that God is just the God of miracles is what happens when we don't need the miracle anymore. Does that make God not the God anymore or irrelevant anymore? Now, at this point of time, there are many people who say, look, Dave, you are a miracle. And I'd say, yes, I am. Does that mean I haven't had drugs? No, I've had a truckload of drugs. And I don't know if it's simply the drugs, because the oncologist didn't expect the drugs to achieve no evidence of cancer. He said it doesn't happen. Right. Now he doesn't say it doesn't happen. He says, well, it's happened at the moment for you, you know.
Yeah.
So I want to say God is both. And there's some commendations in this book. One of them is by a guy called Bruce Robertson, who's the Western Australian of the Year at the moment. He's one of the world's mesothelioma experts. He says at the start of that, it's hard to believe that someone who had 1,500 students praying for them, which I was at a conference with 1,500 students when I got diagnosed, wouldn't be healed straight away. But I wasn't. 15 months later, I've still got evidence of cancer inside me. And we don't know what God's doing, but we can trust him. He doesn't say that he will make all of our circumstances perfect. He says that he will not leave us or forsake us, that he'll walk with us through the valley of death.
Yeah.
And I thank him for that.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, it's funny. When I'm back in ministry this year. It's been a great privilege. I'm pastoring a church in the Western Creek area, just down the road. It meets at Stromlo High School, and we've changed the name of the church to be Stromlo Christian Church. Their pastor left in September last year. It used to be called Central Evangelical Church. It was a little tricky with all of that, and I agreed to take it up. And so I'm back in ministry. My church is looking after me, and I'm looking to serve them. So they don't expect a lot from me 1 week out of three. But I have my chemo on Monday, so that God willing, I'm okay to preach on the Sunday, so long as I've already done all the work before that week starts. So I try and work a preaching, teaching kind of timetable of being at least 2 weeks ahead at all times, and having one of those 2 weeks where I'd be preparing two things, not one. And that's been working through the year. There have been times when I've probably pushed a little hard, and I'm in one of those zones at the moment, actually, where by the end of Sunday I will have spoken 11 times in 2 weeks, because God's opened up a lot of opportunities like this. That's not normal. When I started there, this is the sort of thing that Canberra people ask, what's your 5-year plan? And I laughed. 5 years? If you could guarantee 5 years, you know, whoa! It'd be really nice to plan to still be alive. God willing, Fiona and I have made a commitment to the church for 3 years, and I'm much more consciously looking to prepare the church for my successor, whoever that might be in God's plans. Now, God might enable me to stay there long term. We don't know. But I'm a bit more conscious of the need to keep looking over my shoulder and preparing people. Yeah, Peter. Yeah. Yeah, question about the advice of physical exercise and the benefits of it. Yes, and if my wife was here, she'd be cracking the whip. She's my personal trainer. The physical exercise and a sensible diet and sensible amounts of sleep and a whole range of other things, I think there's proven evidence that it actually helps people in terms of two things. One is the general outcomes of people's health are greater for those who are physically in a reasonable shape. The other is simply for the recovery that's required each time from the chemo. If I get physically run down and sick, recovery will be much more difficult. And there might be times when they say, look, we can't give it to you because you're not well enough to take it. So I need to watch that, because it's been an issue in the past, and I can see now that I'm getting weller that it could be an issue again. Complementary treatments. For the first 15 months of me having chemo, I had acupuncture, which has proven benefits for cutting down on inflammation, reducing nausea, and some other things. Not helping you with the cancer, but helping you to cope with the chemo. And we had an acupuncturist in our church, and she would come round to the house, and that was helpful. And I had to do breathing exercises for a few months. That was my exercise, was to consciously breathe in such a way as to expand my lung capacity. And different people, they also suggest that, as is the case with people with diabetes, that resistance exercise is useful because chemo can actually start to break down the bones and other things. And the way to strengthen the bones is by resistance exercise. Walking is an important one where you're bearing your own body weight, but even perhaps doing circuit classes like with light weights and things can be of great benefit. So, we've found that, look, there's a whole spectrum between ultra-conservative over here and complete wacko, try anything you possibly can over there. And without being prejudicial and biased, it's worth looking at a range of things, but getting sensible people to help weigh them up. And my acupuncturist, for example, also wanted to recommend that I had these particular, and they weren't tasty, kind of herbal concoctions on a regular basis. But it was important for me to discuss that first with the oncologist, because some of those herbs, and they weren't wacko herbs, some of them were really mainstream things that I knew about, others all had Chinese names and I had no idea what they were, could interfere with the chemo. So one particular chemo that I'm on, I can't eat a lot of bananas because it says don't take too much potassium. And so there's no way I would have potassium supplements if I was on that chemo, and I really shouldn't have too many bananas. So, things like that. Yeah. As long as I can, mate. I know God is sovereign and he's in control of whatever happens, so I don't fear that. But coming down a level and thinking about it from a human perspective, to stop the chemo runs risks. That is, if the oncologist is right and it is holding the cancer at bay, to give the cancer an open slate to kind of take a stronghold again and develop new tumours and spread around the body is unwise. But it's also possible that I don't have cancer growing inside me now. I just don't know. So I'll continue with it, but I've already had to stop once for 3 weeks when my kidneys weren't functioning properly. One of the drugs I take, you'd never take it if you took too seriously the side effects. Uncontrolled bleeding, high blood pressure, heart disease, strokes, heart attacks. Now, they're probably just covering themselves against litigation if somebody has any of those things. But I've had that drug now 46 times. I might not be able to continue to have it because it was starting to damage my kidney, so I had to stop.
We may have one more because time is running away. So one more question. I think there was a hand up somewhere around.
There's one over here.
Okay, yep, Gary.
How did I regain the confidence in God, and was there anger involved? For me, anger wasn't the main emotion. there was times of intense frustration, but I'd say the main emotion was just really deep sadness, grief type sadness. How did I regain the hope in God? I don't think that there's a silver bullet kind of answer that, oh, there was this one thing. But I think in God's kindness, having a loving Christian wife and children and friends who would read the Bible with me, who'd pray with me, sometimes getting encouraging messages, opening up the Bible myself and exploring some of these things, it just kind of got re-established over time. And I don't think it got into the pits of despair where I was ready to throw anything in. It was just that kind of niggling doubt. What if, that type of stuff. And I believe that it's important for Christians to be honest about that. And I know that for people who might be, say, looking in and wondering about this Christian thing and is it for real, and they see somebody who's doubting and wavering a little bit, they're unsure, don't see that as evidence against its truthfulness. That's just part of being human. And I think God wants us and even uses those times of doubt and struggle to push us back to deepen and strengthen our trust in Him. Because if it's going to get knocked over every time there's a doubt, we're going to be up and down like yo-yos. And I'm a minister and I still experience these things. Not that that's any guarantee or special privilege.
Yeah.
Some of my atheist mates think that it should be, but it isn't.
Yeah. All right, yeah. I think we'll finish the Q&A there. But just a couple of final questions. So you were given 12 months to live, obviously, in November 2011. It's been, 35 months or so since then. You're still with us. And there have been some real bonuses with that. If we can have the next slide up, please. And who is that?
That's my best mate. We're besties. That's the hip phrase these days, isn't it? Besties. That's Liam. Liam's my grandson. He was born in November last year. So he turned one last week. October last year. He turned one. We're very privileged to have a dual occupancy block with a flat in the back where my son and his wife and my grandson live. So he just waddles in at breakfast time sometimes, wants to know if Grandpa's there. He's really more interested in watching the washing machine, which is a front loader. But, you know, if Grandpa's there, that's good too. So one of my bucket list prayers, you know, people talk about bucket lists when they think they're dying. For me, there were some prayers. One was that I'd get to see a grandchild. And I didn't say this to my married children. I didn't want to put pressure on them. Another was that I would see my second son married because he had a terrific, gorgeous Christian girlfriend. And we thought they were made for each other. He married her. So that was good fun. I got to preach at the wedding last year. I've got a couple of others, but I won't share them just yet. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for talking with us tonight. I think it was really helpful. I hope that that encourages us all. We have a thank you gift for you, and I'll ask our minister, Peter Gadsby, to come up and present that to you.
I think we should clap the interviewer, don't you? Yeah. Well, I'll give you this if you like.
I had to wear that on Sunday. I thought it'd be good for me to, on behalf of us all, and Dave too, to thank Mahawi and the team. They've done a great job getting this evening together, and normally the people that do the organising don't get thanks, so I thought it'd be good to give them a thanks first. Dave, you mentioned when you were speaking about how 2 Corinthians was so very special to you. And as you were speaking, I just picked up a verse or two where Paul writes, "We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired even of life. Indeed, in our hearts we felt the sentence of death. But this happened that we might not rely on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead. He has delivered us from such a deadly peril, and he will deliver us. On him we have set our hope, that he will continue to deliver us as you help us by your prayers. then many will give thanks on our behalf for the gracious favour granted us in answer to the prayers of many. And while those were the words of the Apostle Paul, I think we can see how the Lord has been so gracious in your life. And we've prayed for you here on a number of occasions over the last 3 years.
Thank you.
So. And we rejoice to know you're back in ministry. It's really wonderful. And on behalf of us all, I really do want to thank you very much for... You had a very busy couple of weeks, as you said. And I know this last week's not been that easy. But here you are, and you've done a great job this evening. We've really appreciated it. And may the Lord richly bless you.
Thank you.
Now, in our congregation, we have one or two people who are really good at photography, and one of them, Dave Coleman, has given us permission to have a print reproduced for you. I haven't seen it, so if you don't mind opening it...
Very happy to. Yeah.
And show us what it's like.
Oh, there you go. I've got one just like it.
The other way.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you. So.
Yeah, well done, mate.
Yep, that's close to where I live, actually. Yeah. On the north side, yeah.
Excellent.
Thank you.
And just a...
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks, heaps.
Thank you. Please take a seat. Well, there's only a handful of things left for us to do before we finish up. And as I just remind you, there will be coffee and tea. And Dave will be happy to have a chat with you if you want to speak with him. But also his book is available for purchase at the back there. So, yeah, do check that out. The other thing that we'd like you to... We'd really love to hear how you thought tonight went. We'd like to hear your feedback. There is a feedback form, I think, that the guys have been giving out. So if you could fill that in right now, that'd be great. And there's some more with Daniel at the back. So if you need one, just grab one from him. And also, we run Christianity Explored course here in our church every now and then. And if you want to explore more about Jesus of the Bible, we'd love you to join that. So there is a contact that you can leave in that form if you'd like to do that. Yep. One more thing. I'll play the introduction to the intro or the trailer to Christianity Explored just as we finish up. Otherwise, that's it. Thank you very much, Dave, and enjoy tea and coffee.
Good. Can I just say, if you want to get copies of the book, I brought a whole stack here tonight. They're only $10 tonight. If you could kind of go to get them soon, I, silly me, double booked myself tonight for a very close friend's birthday. Now, my wife is there, but I won't stay terribly late, so I'll at least make an appearance at my friend's birthday, so I'll head at some stage soon. Thanks.
And also, I gather that you're happy to write a little message.
Yeah, if you're wanting to give the book to somebody and you'd just like me to write a little note to them or something, I'm more than happy to do that if you... Grab me soon. Yep. Thanks. Cool.